Today is Thursday, October 12th. We're going to be talking about respiratory physiology today.
Okay. Top of page 72 has a pathway of airflow for you. There's a couple of blanks that we'll need to fill in and that oxygen flow pathway. So let me take you through that so you have the right blanks to study by. And one of those tracings, either the oxygen or the carbon dioxide out, we'll put on the test number 3. And the easy thing is, they're identical. It's just one is the reverse of the other, so that makes it easy to keep those straight. Okay, so let's see. We've got NARS, nasal turbinates. What is next?
Nasopharynx.
Nasopharynx, good. Then we've got oropharynx and laryngopharynx is next. Naso, oro, laryngopharynx. All right, then we travel through the larynx, and that opening in the larynx is called the glottis. We travel next into the trachea, so now we're entering that lower respiratory pathway. And from the trachea, we pass into a first set of branches. They are called?
Primary.
Good. So primary bronchi, that's your next blank. Okay, and then we've got secondary bronchi, tertiary bronchi. The tiniest passageways are called?
Bronchioles.
Good, bronchioles. And in some of those smaller bronchioles, we can perform gas exchange, but the main place we always talk about gas exchange are those thin-walled alveoli. Okay, and from this point, we're now going to load oxygen into the bloodstream. We take it into pulmonary capillaries. This should be a familiar pathway. We go from the capillaries to pulmonary venules to pulmonary
veins.
Good, pulmonary veins. We get dumped into a chamber of the heart known as
left atrium.
Good. All right, so we travel then through bicuspid valve, left ventricle, aortic semilunar valve.
Aortic,
good. And here we go out for systemic flow, arteries, arterioles, capillaries, venules, veins, SVC, IVC, back to the?
Right atrium.
You got it, right atrium. So just to demonstrate that carbon dioxide's flow out is just in reverse, let's do just a few of those steps. This time I picked you up with the pulmonary capillaries surrounding the alveoli. We are going to unload the carbon dioxide into the bronchioles. Okay, from the alveoli, carbon dioxide goes to bronchioles. And then just go backwards, tertiary, secondary, primary bronchi. Okay, so tertiary, secondary, primary bronchi. You good to go from there?
Just the reverse of the other
one. Yeah, just go backwards on the other one. So I'll give y'all a minute to jot that down. Okay, feel pretty comfortable with those flow tracings. Okay. get into some of the physiology of how the respiratory system works now. About halfway down your page, you've got the functions of the respiratory system. You probably learned this in grade school, that the respiratory system exchanges blood gases. And of course, oxygen is the gas we want to load into the bloodstream, and carbon dioxide is what we want to unload from the bloodstream. Just to kind of take this full circle, you know, we've talked about the cardiovascular system, we've talked about blood vessels, and we tie in the heart and lungs with those blood vessels in gas transport. So it's kind of hard to talk about respiratory gas transport without mentioning blood vessels as part of that pathway. Just to kind of give us an idea of why we need oxygen and why we need to get rid of CO2, we have to look at the mitochondria. So I just wanted to remind you of hopefully what you've heard of maybe in Bio 110 or maybe high school biology some time ago. The mitochondria is an organelle inside our cells, and its job is to make what energy molecule?
ATP,
good. One of the reactants for ATP is a good amount of oxygen that we have to bring in through the respiratory system and gas transport. And the process of making ATP actually produces CO2. So we think of CO2 as a waste product. It has to be removed from our bodies. So it's kind of interesting to think that our entire respiratory system is serving those mitochondria. So we have an entire system just to make sure we can make those ATP molecules. Okay, so in terms of the four events of respiration, respiration is a term that more specifically has to do with the gas exchanges that are involved in breathing. You know, when we talk about breathing in and out, we're actually talking about only one of these functions here. Which function is just simply breathing?
Pulmonary.
Yeah, pulmonary ventilation is the term that means just breathing. Okay, now, when we talk about respiration, you've heard of cellular respiration, right? Okay, and that is the process of making ATP in the mitochondria. Now, when we talk about external respiration, we're actually talking here about a gas exchange that will occur. In your lungs, between your pulmonary capillaries and your alveoli, we're going to do an exchange by diffusion. What gas will move into our bloodstream by diffusion from the air?
Oxygen,
good. Since we're moving oxygen from the air that we breathe into our bloodstream, should we call this loading or unloading?
Loading.
Call it loading, exactly. So we load the oxygen into the bloodstream, we then transport it throughout the body for distribution. Likewise, carbon dioxide will be unloaded from your pulmonary capillaries into the air that you exhale, and it's then removed from the body. Okay, so I kind of think of this like taking a trip. If you load your suitcase into the car, you're going somewhere, and if you unload your suitcase, or in other words, if you unload your CO2, you're done. You're taking it out. So that's the process we need to keep straight here in the lungs with external respiration. So why do you think they call this particular gas exchange an external respiration? Why not some other name? Yeah, it has to do with the outside world. So this is the place where the outside world performs a gas exchange with our bodies. So the lungs, the alveoli, this is where the outside air gets exchanged with our blood. Let's go back to our list of the four events of respiration. We already know about respiratory gas transport. We know that when oxygen is loaded into the bloodstream at the lungs, we transport it by way of pulmonary capillaries back to pulmonary venules, pulmonary veins, then where? Yeah, left atrium. We eject it out of the aorta, it goes out for a systemic flow, and then comes back to the heart, and ultimately ends up back at the lungs. Those kinds of flow pathways that we refer to as pulmonary circuits and systemic circuits, those are part of that respiratory gas transport. All right, so we have one more major job of the respiratory system in terms of events, and that is internal respiration. Internal respiration implies a location. This is no longer the gas exchange that occurs at the lungs. Where do we find internal gas exchange occurring?
Inside.
inside, right? So all over your body, in between your cells and tissues and capillaries, we find an exchange that occurs there. So this exchange now is reversed from external respiration. What should we do with the oxygen traveling in your bloodstream?
Unloaded,
good. So your cells and tissues now are nourished with oxygen. They can make ATP. And those cells are making carbon dioxide. So what should we do with that CO2?
Pick it up
and load it, yeah. So we take this CO2 back to the heart and the lungs where we can get rid of it through exhaled air. I just want to let you know that what is on the bottom of page 72 is a snapshot of where we're going. There's more details we're going to add to the story, but this is basically our outline for today's class period and probably a little bit of Tuesday's as well. All right, so it looks like we're ready to move into pulmonary ventilation. That is found on page 73. Boy, what a simple name. This is just breathing, and they've come up with this name of pulmonary ventilation that explains what breathing is and how breathing occurs. To bring air into our lungs, we call it inhalation or inspiration. And to move air out of your lungs, they call it exhalation or expiration. I don't know about expiration. It makes it sound like it's my last breath ever, right?
Yeah, inspiration sounds really nice, but then the expiration part, you're like, ah.
I'm inspired, now I die, right? So it doesn't sound very good. Bringing air in is inspiration, right? So inhalation, inspiration are the same. Exhalation, expiration are the same. I'm going to grab the lights for just a few minutes. Let's talk about Boyle's Law. Okay, so Boyle's Law is going to drive our process of pulmonary ventilation. And pulmonary ventilation is based on pressure and volume. Those are two variables that we're going to look at, pressure and volume. And I thought probably instead of messing with lungs and all that stuff, we would just talk about boxes. And if you think about a small volume box, you know, you're talking about something that doesn't have a whole lot of space for the air to fit into. A large volume box has more room for the air to spread out. So when we're talking about pressure and volume, we're actually talking about two inversely related variables. All right, so now I'm using some Greek words here. What does it mean when variables are inversely related?
Opposite.
Yeah, they're opposite. So if I have a small volume box, the air molecules in there can be crammed. And if we continue to squeeze and make that box even smaller, probably a good example here would be like a potato chip bag. If you take a potato chip bag and you squeeze, it's going to pop, right? Mm-hmm. So what are you doing to the pressure when you make the volume smaller?
Increase it.
You're increasing it, yeah. So in a small volume or a small space, we're going to see the pressure increase. Boyle's Law in the back of our head. We're going to hang on to that concept because that is what drives air movement into and out of our lungs. So the inverse relationship here between pressure and volume is what pushes the air out when you exhale, and it's what pulls or sucks air in when you inhale. So we're just gonna kind of hang on to that, and then we're gonna move down here to these two pictures. So in order to talk about inhalation and exhalation, I need to mention three pressures to you. On your worksheet, you'll notice they are atmospheric pressure, intrapulmonary pressure, and intrapleural pressure. Let's talk about atmospheric pressure first. This is the pressure of the air around your body. At sea level, we say that atmospheric pressure is around 760 millimeters mercury. We could also use another unit called atmospheres, but we're going to talk right now about millimeters mercury, that form of pressure, that kind of unit of pressure. So I'm just going to put outside the body here, atmospheric pressure is about 760 millimeters mercury. So these are where those word roots and vocab words come back to help us. Intrapulmonary pressure is where?
In the lungs.
In the lungs, yes. So intrapulmonary pressure is in the lungs. I'm going to write that over here. Contrasting colors of chalk. I hope you can see that I've got a blue color of chalk, and I think it's like a peach color of chalk. And I wanted to show you the two pleura membranes surrounding the lungs on the outside. That's going to help us understand intrapleural pressure. That is the pressure between those two serous membranes. So in blue, this is the one that's closest to your lung. This particular pleural membrane is called
visceral.
Good. So we'll just go ahead and label that one. That one's visceral. The lighter colored chalk there that's closest to your thoracic cavity wall, that is called our parietal pleura. So what's between those two layers?
Intrapleural
pressure, good, and there's serous fluid in there. And that serous fluid between those two creates that intrapleural pressure. Okay, so serous fluid between those two layers, that's where we find that intrapleural pressure. Creates that pressure. Okay, so I think we're now ready to talk about inhalation first. So in the chart down below, let's hit inhalation or inspiration. In order for you to breathe in, there is a pacemaker in your brain. It's in, again, that medulla oblongata. And the pacemaker says, breathe. There's a nerve impulse that travels down your phrenic nerves. Those phrenic nerves travel through your neck on either side in that cervical plexus. And those phrenic nerves stimulate not only your diaphragm, which sits up underneath the base of your lungs, it also sits, or that phrenic nerve rather also innervates the internal, and actually the external intercostal muscles between your ribs. So when the phrenic nerve sends an impulse to diaphragm and external intercostals, the message, of course, is to contract. So you're noticing here, this picture has a rib cage that's flared out. That's what happens when our external intercostal muscles contract. It moves the rib cage out so that you have more room to breathe. Okay, get that air into your lungs. The diaphragm is going to move down flat toward your stomach, and that also is going to increase the volume in your thoracic cavity. Okay.
So that's when it's contracted. The diaphragm is contracted when it moves down.
It moves down.
Okay.
play a musical instrument, maybe in high school, sing, talk a lot?
Yeah.
I talk a lot, yeah. So if you do any of those things, like I used to play trumpet in high school, and you know, if you played for a long time, your diaphragm pushed on your stomach, and it almost made you feel like you had a stomachache from breathing deeply all the time. So some of you probably have experienced that where you're constantly breathing and talking, singing, or you know, blowing a horn like I was doing in high school. So the point here is the diaphragm is going to push down against your stomach, and when it does that, it increases the volume in your thoracic cavity. So I hope you see that there's a bigger space here for those lungs to spread out. We know from having talked about Boyle's Law, if you increase the volume, what happens to your intrapulmonary pressure?
Decreases.
It decreases. Good. So we're going to increase your volume. I'm almost out of room there. I'm going to decrease your intrapulmonary pressure. Okay, so you know how pressure gradients work, right? So if I have an atmospheric pressure of 760 outside your body, in order for air to flow from a high pressure to a low pressure inside my lungs, what must intrapulmonary pressure be? Yeah, lower than 760. So let's just pick 758, and we'll say that that's what our intrapulmonary pressure becomes. All right, so now we have high pressure outside the body, we've got low pressure inside the lungs, and air is literally going to follow a pressure gradient and get sucked into your lungs, kind of like a vacuum cleaner. You don't normally hear yourself suck air in, and you don't hear it from most people unless that person has some kind of respiratory disorder. You may hear the wheezing noise when you're inhaling. But otherwise, we suck air in thanks to that diaphragm pushing down flatter, and that increases the volume, decreases the pressure. So you're saying, okay, there's three pressures here, atmospheric pressure outside the body. Intrapulmonary is the one that has to decrease for you to breathe in. What role does intrapleural pressure play? This is the pressure that keeps your lungs inflated. Okay, so it has to always remain -2 or less than your intrapulmonary pressure. Okay, so saying it's -2 your intrapulmonary pressure is really just fancy language. We're saying intrapleural pressure has to be lower than intrapulmonary pressure. So if my intrapulmonary pressure is 758, what must my intrapleural pressure be? Lower. Yes, so let's pick something like 755, and then that way we see it's less than our intrapulmonary pressure. Pretty good sense to think about it this way, because if you have a pressure around your lungs that's squeezing your lungs as they're trying to inflate with air, you're not going to get any air to move in, right? So if you happen to have a lower pressure surrounding your lungs in that space between the two pleura, then that allows for the lungs to inflate. So that's the catch here. The intrapleural pressure is always going to be less than your intrapulmonary pressure. That's going to help to keep your lungs inflated. If you ever have an intrapleural pressure greater than your intrapulmonary pressure, what happens to your lungs?
They collapse.
They collapse, right? So it's too much of a squeeze, they can't inflate, they collapse. So in terms of timing here, when your medulla and that pacemaker in your brain says it's time for you to breathe, you inspire or inhale for about 2 to 3 seconds. That gives you time for your diaphragm to contract and push down, and it gives you time to suck air into your lungs. After that 2 or 3 seconds, that respiratory pacemaker cuts off, and then, of course, your diaphragm returns back to a dome-shaped position. So I hope you can see over here, the diaphragm has relaxed. What's happened to the external intercostal muscles?
They relaxed.
They relaxed, yes. So all these muscles relax.
So does that mean the internal intercostals
contract?
During expiration?
Yeah.
Actually, there's no contraction.
Okay.
But if you forcibly, if you say,
right.
You try to force it out, then they can contract then.
Okay. But inspiration, there is contraction.
Yeah. External intercostals and diaphragm contract. That's right. I want to emphasize that to exhale, it is completely a passive process. This means that you don't have to work to exhale. Our lung tissue is elastic, and like, here we go, underwear again. If you stretch it, it should do what when you let go? Relax, recoil back, yeah. So if you've got healthy elastic tissue in the lungs, when you expand through inhalation, once the inhalation is done, those lungs should recoil back to their original shape, and that is what pushes the air out. So it doesn't require you to do any kind of work. There's no ATP involved in exhalation. It is simply the relaxation of your diaphragm and your external intercostals and the lung elasticity that forces the air out of the lungs. Now, if you're climbing the stairs in this building, I'm sure you've done that, right? Come up those stairs, you're gonna be forcefully exhaling, and there are muscles that can help force air out. But just sitting here at your desk today, you're probably doing nothing more than just passive exhalation. So let's talk about how you get the air out of your lungs. Compare the volume of your thoracic cavity. Inhalation, we had a great volume. What happened to that volume when you start to exhale? Volume decreases. And if volume decreases, your pressure inside the lungs will increase. By the way, that pressure in the lungs is called intrapulmonary pressure. And let's just pick a number. In order for you to exhale, the pressure in your internal spaces has to be greater than the atmospheric pressure. So how about a number for intrapulmonary pressure? 761, that'll work. Okay, so of course, air follows a pressure gradient. It's going to flow from high pressure in your lungs to the low pressure outside your body, and exhalation is complete. Just want to keep the story going for that intrapleural pressure between your two pleural membranes. It has to always be less than your intrapulmonary pressure to maintain lung inflation. So why don't we say 758, and that way we still keep it less than your lung pressure inside.
So does the volume of that change at all?
Of that intrapleural?
Right.
It just stretches when you're breathing in.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know that they necessarily look at that as being a volume issue as much as they do the intrapleural pressure and volume relationship inside the lungs, but it's got to if you're inhaling because you're stretching mm-hmm. that space out.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, I just think of it like as a balloon, and like if you're inhaling, you're squeezing it more, but I don't know how that works. Because the pressure is more on the exhalation.
Yeah, the pressure is what forces it out during exhalation. Speaking of balloon, and we can play with this, this may also give you guys a visual to look at. This is a real cool little contraption. You can almost make one of these at home with a cup and a rubber glove on the bottom and a straw at the top. This thing is sealed up, so the only way air can come and go is by way of this plastic straw. And if we pull on this piece of like glove tissue at the bottom, watch those lungs inflate when you pull down. That's like the diaphragm moving inferiorly during inhalation. And then when you exhale, watch what happens to them when you push up. The air completely is forced out of them and they completely deflate. So what's happening to the volume in here when you push up on that diaphragm?
No,
yeah, volume decreases and the pressure inside here will increase, yeah. So the only thing this thing doesn't really illustrate is what happens with that intrapleural pressure, but you know, it's pretty good for letting us see inhalation and exhalation. So pretty cool. Any questions? questions so far. Do you feel pretty good with this? Okay, so the main things to keep straight are muscles contract during inhalation. That leads to increased volume, decreased pressure, air sucks into your lungs. Okay, and then upon exhalation, muscles will relax. What happens to volume?
It decreases.
Volume decreases, intrapulmonary pressure will
increase,
air is forced out. So if you can keep it straight in that order, that's basically the story of breathing. So we've kind of talked about this stuff before, back when we discussed blood vessels and blood pressure and blood flow. So I'd like to just mention one more time that there are things that can impede the process of air moving throughout your respiratory system. So airway resistance is something that can impede airflow. Anybody else see the picture? Airway resistance is something that can impede airflow into your lungs. The simple fact that you're traveling from a diameter that's large in the trachea to progressively smaller diameters through the bronchi and bronchioles, that alone will reduce the airflow into your lungs. How do you reduce alveolar surface tension? In other words, how do you keep the lung tissue from sticking?
Surfactant.
Surfactant. That's it. And it's an oily secretion that keeps those tissues from sticking together. And then finally, lung compliance is the stretchiness of your lung tissue. Healthy lung tissue is not only able to stretch, but most importantly, for exhalation, it can recoil back to its original shape. So things like smoking and lung diseases can damage that resilience of the lung tissue, and that reduces the compliance. You know, when we looked at the pictures of emphysema on Tuesday, you notice how the muscle wasting had occurred around the chest cavity. That's because the people with emphysema have to force out the air during exhalation. When for the rest of us, you know, if you have a healthy respiratory system, there is no forcing, there's no work that has to be done to get the air to go back out. All right, so it looks like we're ready to flip the page. How about questions so far? Similar to when we talked about how the heart works and how the heart had a pacemaker, the respiratory rate is also something that's controlled by a set of pacemaker cells in your brain. So once again, we're going back to that medulla oblongata. Not only does it have a home for your cardiovascular center, it also has a control center for the respiratory system. So we're looking at the medulla. Even the pons here also has some control over respiration. And what are the names of the nerves that carry nerve impulses from your brain through your neck and down to your ribs and diaphragm? Phrenic, yes. Yeah. So the phrenic nerve is actually the nerve that tells the external intercostals to contract, as well as the diaphragm. So we normally think of respiration as being an involuntarily controlled issue. Okay, but we can learn to talk early in life, and we control how to override those pacemakers, and we have conscious cognizant control over that breathing process. So our cerebral cortex can exert control over respiration. All right, so let's talk about the timing issue here. When the medulla, or that respiratory center in your medulla, fires a nerve impulse, the nerve impulse travels through each side of your neck in the phrenic nerve and stimulates your external intercostals and diaphragm to contract. That nerve impulse is going to be on for about 2 seconds. That promotes inhalation. After 2 seconds, that phrenic nerve stops firing an impulse. And if there's no message being sent to your external intercostals and diaphragm, what happens to them?
Relax.
They relax, right. So for the next 3 seconds, those muscles relax, pressure increases, volume decreases, and air flows out of the lungs. Okay, so let's hit those blanks there on your page. The first blank there on the top of page 74 is phrenic nerve. That one's spelled P-H-R-E-N-I-C. I feel like I'm in a spelling bee, phrenic. P-H-R-E-N-I-C. Okay, and volume will do what?
Decrease,
yeah, and pressure will
increase.
You got it. Pressure will increase, and then of course you. Oh, that's inhalation. So volume increases, pressure decreases. Let's make sure we got those. Okay. So yeah, inhalation, volume increases, pressure decreases. So it's 2 seconds on of the phrenic nerve, 3 seconds off. So you inhale for about 2 seconds, you exhale for about 3 seconds. That means that on average you're looking at about a 5 second cycle to breathe in and out. Every time you breathe in and out, you're moving a tidal volume of around 500 milliliters of air. And if you do this, say, over a minute's time, we're looking at 12 to 15 breaths per minute, and you're moving around 7 liters of air into and out of your lungs every minute. Okay, so that's kind of something to consider, how much oxygen it is that we need to make this ATP. This normal respiration rate is called eupnea. It should be bolded there, eupnea. Okay, so different textbooks are going to give you a different value for eupnea. I believe the one I've got in the course pack here says something like 12 to 18 or 12 to 15 breaths per minute. I believe other textbooks even say as many as 12 to 20 breaths per minute is normal. Okay, so depending on what textbook you pick up, they're going to give you a different range. What I have seen, though, in common is the low end cutoff seems to always be 12. The top end, though, can be 15, 18, or 20 breaths per minute. All right, so little kids breathe faster than adults. Just want to put that out there. Little kids' respiration rate is much faster.
I feel like I breathe more than that.
Yeah. Be interesting to time yourself and see, you know, what at rest you actually do, you know.
Well, what, like, makes someone a heavy breather? Like, if you can hear them breathing more. Like, I don't know. I'm a heavy breather. So, and I just never understood why, like, you know, you can hear me breathing but not hear other people. And it's not like I'm wheezing.
Is it sleeping or is it wake during wake?
Both, yeah, either or.
I don't really know what makes the noise factor. So, because I would assume you have a healthy respiratory system. And I'm not sure what makes a healthy respiratory system for one person louder than someone else's.
I have a friend who has a deviated septum, and she's a heavy breather, and she's like...
it could be sinuses. Yeah. I think we all have sinus issues living around here, yeah. We all could breathe heavy breathers. Okay, so we got eupnea out of the way. Dyspnea is difficulty breathing, or as they notate on paperwork, SOB, right? Shortness of breath. Okay, I always think that's funny when they write down SOB. Okay, so when you talk about shortness of breath, can't catch your breath, that's dyspnea. We've probably all heard of apnea, right? No breathing, absence of breathing, 0 breaths per minute. And hypertonia is forceful breathing. So if you want to be a monster for Halloween, right? Okay. Darth Vader, yeah, there you go. So I can still breathe 12 to 18 breaths per minute, and I can still stay in a normal rhythm, but I can do it like Darth Vader, right? Okay, so you can maintain normal rate, but if it's forced breathing, you can then do hypertonia. I make the issue because when we talk about hyperventilation and hypoventilation, that is in fact a rate change And the rate change means that you're breathing faster than the normal 12 to 18 breaths per minute, or slower than, which is hypoventilation. The driving force behind these rate changes is chemical changes in your bloodstream. Okay, so the driving force behind hyper and hypoventilation is a chemical change in your bloodstream. Does anybody need Boyle's Law over here on this side of the board? I think I'll erase that part then. Lights on to see that?
No.
No?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. Okay, so that's on the worksheet. I need to talk you through this thing. Okay, so you probably recognize carbon dioxide down here, and there's water. That is water of your bloodstream and of your red blood cells. So let's talk about carbon dioxide. It's made by mitochondria when you're making ATP. You move it into the bloodstream, into capillaries, and the most common method of transport is not as a bubbly gas in your bloodstream, but it actually combines with the water of your red blood cells and forms something that we call bicarbonate ions, which is way down here at the other end of this equation. So I want you to think that you've got like champagne blood. You don't have bubbles of gas traveling. How sad, right? You don't have bubbles of gas traveling back to your heart and lungs to exhale. Instead, that gas dissolves in your bloodstream and then is transported as an ion. So when we combine carbon dioxide and water, it makes a middleman called carbonic acid. Ah, that's good to know, right? Because we recognize acids as having that hydrogen in the front of the compound. And carbonic acid dissolves in water to produce these two ions, hydrogen ions and bicarbonate ions. Okay? To acid-base balance. Okay, so we're going to piecemeal acid-base balance throughout the course. We're going to do a little bit now, we'll do a little bit later. You'll eventually get the whole story, but it's relevant to conversation now with respiration. So carbon dioxide can actually make your bloodstream more acidic. And this is how. When you put carbon dioxide in your bloodstream and it combines with water, it forms this acid, carbonic acid, that breaks down into hydrogen ions and this bicarbonate ion. This is coming full circle to basic chemistry. What effect do hydrogen ions have on your blood pH? Make it more
acidic.
Yeah. So if you have lots of carbon dioxide built up in your bloodstream, you're going to have a lot of hydrogen ions built up in your bloodstream. And that makes your bloodstream more acidic. So because your respiratory system may not be removing those CO2 molecules quickly enough, then we say that the reason for this acidosis is a respiratory issue. And so we call it respiratory acidosis. Okay? Let's flip it the other direction. Let's say that your respiratory system is removing carbon dioxide really fast, so you don't have enough CO2 in your bloodstream. If you remove the CO2 really quickly, what about those hydrogens? Are they building up in your bloodstream?
No, they're not.
They're removed too, yeah. looking at a more alkaline or basic blood pH. And because we say the respiratory systems are moving those maybe too quickly, then we're calling this problem respiratory, you got it, alkalosis. Good. Heads up for later on. Those hydrogens can acidify the bloodstream. This stuff here, this bicarbonate ion, this can actually make your blood become more basic or alkaline. Okay, so this is something we're going to head off when we get into the renal system or urinary system. We're going to manage these two if your respiratory system cannot. So we can swing this particular reaction toward the left, and we can get rid of these two by breathing them out of CO2, or we can swing this reaction to the right and let the renal or urinary system manage these issues. So for a patient with emphysema, let's take that as an example. What do they build up in their lungs? Well, they have an obstructive disorder, so they can't exhale out enough
CO2.
So that CO2 is going to back up in their lungs and their bloodstream. If you increase the CO2 levels, what happens to your hydrogen ion?
It increases.
Increases. So we see a patient with emphysema having respiratory
acidosis.
Exactly. Okay. If you know you're scared by something, you know you start hyperventilating, you remove more CO2. And you have less hydrogens, and you end up now with a problem called alkalosis. Yeah, respiratory alkalosis. So this whole relationship can swing back and forth because our goal is to maintain a blood pH around what? Yeah, 7.35 to 7.45. So this is what we're doing, is we're regulating blood pH by swinging between carbon dioxide, hydrogens, and bicarbonate. Okay, so let's also talk about this issue of hydrogens and pH for just a moment. I think I'll come back down here. Okay. So we know normal pH is for the blood around 7.35 to 7.45. If you drop below 7.35, what are you accumulating in your bloodstream? Yeah, you've got acidosis. You've probably got a buildup of carbon dioxide and hydrogens, right? So head below, you're looking at acidosis. That comes from a buildup of hydrogens and carbon dioxide. Let me put this out there. This is a tripping point for some people. When you think about the pH dropping lower, it's kind of hard to say that increasing is causing that drop in pH. So what are we increasing when we see our pH go down?
Acid.
Acid. Yeah, an increase in acid, such as hydrogens or carbon dioxide, will actually cause a decrease in pH. So I know it feels kind of wrong to say it that way, but that's in fact what happens. If you head above 7.45, we are now looking at too few what ions? Hydrogen. Yeah, and most likely too few carbon dioxide. Life expectancy. exists between a range of 6.8 as our absolute low end and 7.8 as our absolute top end. And most of the time, we're not looking at going up with our pH, we're looking at going down. So most pH imbalances involve heading into this acidosis territory. Okay, so 6.8, the low cutoff, you know, going back to when you studied proteins, what happens to proteins in a very acidic environment?
They don't work,
they denature, exactly. So that's pretty much our low-end cutoff. So that's why the respiratory and the renal system can be involved in removing those excess hydrogen ions. All right, so I think we can come back full circle to the worksheet now. Hyperventilation is a respiratory rate. The whole reason we hyperventilate is to get rid of extra
CO2.
Yeah, so that's really a goal there for us. So when you do this, when you hyperventilate, you're going to see lower CO2 levels. That's a condition known as hypocapnia. Okay, hypocapnia is too little carbon dioxide. Okay, and the more CO2 you lose, the more alkaline your blood pH becomes, and you've got a condition called respiratory alkalosis. All right, and the faster you breathe, what happens to your oxygen levels?
Increase,
yeah. And this may not sound like a bad deal, you know, to have extra oxygen hanging around, but actually too much oxygen can be detrimental to your cells, it can be toxic to our cells. So we don't necessarily need more than a certain amount of oxygen in our bloodstream.
Is that something you can do from just breathing, or would that be like if you're on an oxygen machine and like breathing really deep or something?
Probably on an oxygen machine,
okay.
Yeah. I'm not sure that you're going to cause toxicity just going, yeah. So flip it the other way. Hyperventilation is a way to change our blood chemistry, and it too will cause effects with blood pH and CO2 levels. So we call the excess CO2 that builds up through hypoventilation hypercapnia. There's other names for it. You may find it in different textbooks. Okay, and the more CO2 you build up, the more acid you have in your bloodstream, and we lead to a condition called respiratory acidosis. So the slower we breathe, the less oxygen we get in, and that leads to a condition that can be called hypoxia. So you guys know this story already. We've actually done this story to some extent. This is the same story that we did with blood pressure regulation back in, you know, the last chapter. There are chemoreceptors that are sitting in your common carotid arteries in your neck and your aortic arch, and there are also central chemoreceptors that are sitting in your brain. Back when you guys took Bio-210, you may have heard about the blood-brain barrier. That ring a bell? Okay. There is no blood-brain barrier over the hypothalamus or the medulla, and that's because the medulla actually houses central chemoreceptors, and it monitors blood pH and these chemistry issues like CO2 and oxygen. So we're looking at a way here to regulate respiration in case there happens to be blood chemistry issues that need to be fixed. This should sound really familiar, right? Something we did back in our blood vessel and blood pressure chapter. So let me give you an example. Let's say that we're traveling in the mountains, you know, really high mountains, 10, 15,000 feet mountains, and you're used to life in the lowlands, okay? So you are now in a place where there is less oxygen in the atmosphere. What type of receptor picks up on the lack of oxygen in your bloodstream? A chemoreceptor, right. Those chemoreceptors tell your medulla oblongata, there's a respiratory center this time, and that respiratory center says, hey, we need to breathe faster. And so we increase stimulation to the phrenic nerve that runs through your neck. And what happens now to your respiration rate?
It increases.
It increases, right. Do we call this increase in respiration hypo or hyperventilation?
Hyper.
Hyper, good. So in breathing faster, what should we see to our oxygen levels?
Increase.
Increased, right. And how about our CO2 levels when we breathe faster?
Decrease,
right. Okay, let's do another one. Let's say that we have a person who took too many antacids, Toms. You know, we think that Toms over the counter are harmless, but unfortunately they can cause your blood to become too alkaline. All right, now this condition means that we do not have enough hydrogen ions. The lack of hydrogen ions is picked up once again by chemoreceptors. And where do we tattletale this information to?
The medulla.
Medulla oblongata, good. The medulla says, your blood pH is too alkaline. You need more acid in your bloodstream. So how should we alter your respiration rate to get more acid?
Lower it.
Hypoventilate. How does hypoventilation give you more acid?
Increase
your carbon dioxide. And the more CO2 you keep, the more... You got it, more hydrogen ions you're going to have. The more hydrogens you have, the lower your pH goes. So for a person who's had an overdose of, say, Toms or antacids, what do you notice about them? They're breathing really heavy. Yeah, they're breathing really slow. So that could be a really bad thing because their breathing could actually slow too low. Okay. Instead of me talking you through all the examples, giving all the fun away, let me flip you on over to page 76. And let me give you a moment to work as far as you can on that page. I'd like to give you answers before you leave today. And if you want to buddy up with a partner, go ahead. And we'll do answers on those 10 questions before you guys head out. Okay, let's start with number one. We'll do a few of these. Would you guys like to finish them for homework? Okay. Let me do at least maybe the first five, just to make sure you're on the right track with it. The first question there, you're noticing that the person has acidosis. That's the problem. A buildup of hydrogen ions in the bloodstream. So that's our stimulus. We've got a case of acidosis. And we're going to learn when we get further into acid-base balance that if you've got a kidney problem, you can't necessarily expect the kidneys to fix their problem. They may be not able to excrete enough hydrogen ions. And you can't necessarily expect the respiratory system to fix its problems. So these two systems often compensate for each other. So the point here is that if you've got a metabolic acidosis condition, you're probably going to fix it with a respiratory alkalosis condition. All right, so letter B, how does the respiratory center compensate to get rid of these hydrogen ions?
Increase respiratory rate,
yeah. So you should breathe faster. And that's called hyperventilation. And when you hyperventilate, what are you removing from your bloodstream?
CO2 and
hydrogen. Good. CO2, you lower those hydrogen ions. So for letter C, how does the respiration rate restore blood pH to normal? You do it by removing excess CO2 and hydrogens.
Is it okay if I put increased oxygen? Do I need to have both?
Actually, oxygen's not a concern or an issue here.
Okay.
So we're probably just going to focus on that CO2 and hydrogen issue. We are going to probably talk about it on Tuesday, but CO2 is the most important stimulus to influence respiration, actually not oxygen, oddly enough. Hey, we actually did number two. The stimulus here for having too many antacids is what problem? Yeah, alkalosis. So number 2A is alkalosis. How does the respiratory center compensate?
Decrease,
yeah, hypoventilation, decrease respiration. OK, Okay, and by breathing more slowly, what do you accumulate in your bloodstream? Good.
More CO2.
Keep more CO2 and hydrogen. That's exactly right. You retain or keep more CO2 and more hydrogens. We actually did number three as well. If you hike in a high elevation and there's less oxygen, the stimulus this time is actually low levels of oxygen. So 3A, we've got low oxygen levels. Too little oxygen means that your respiratory center, or RC, should respond by doing what?
Hyperventilation.
Hyperventilation, right. Speed up that breathing. So 3B, we should hyperventilate. How does the rate change help you restore oxygen levels to normal? Yeah, don't worry about the CO2, it's not an issue here, it's just simply getting in more
oxygen.
Yeah, that's the big deal, getting the more oxygen for this one. How you doing so far? Getting these right so far? Number four. If you see someone breathing quickly, what imbalance must have led to hyperventilation?
Acidosis.
Yeah, they must have had excess CO2, excess hydrogens. Yeah, so their condition must have been acidosis. Have you had a chance to work number five yet? Okay, so if you've got aspirin overdose for number five, and that causes overstimulation of your respiratory center, what pH imbalance are you heading for?
Alkalosis,
yeah. And the reason we're heading into alkalosis? You got it, yeah. Increased breathing is lowering the hydrogen content and CO content. Good, so increased respiration lowers your hydrogen ion and CO2 content in the bloodstream.
Yeah.
Sure. That is correct, but he's compensating for a problem. And the problem he's compensating for is actually acidosis. And by breathing faster, he's apparently fixing some part of his blood chemistry that's out of whack. But you're right, the hyperventilation is going to lead you to alkalosis, and that's the seesaw effect that we're going for there. Does that make sense? For you can have alkalosis, and why is because you're going to be removing too many hydrogens and too many CO2 from the bloodstream. If you guys will finish that, we'll do answers in here on Tuesday. Sure.